So we're looking at Romans chapter 7, and I think what we've said about the law so far has been fairly negative. We've said, first of all, that to become a Christian, you have to die to the law. It's impossible to be united to law and to Christ. We must belong to the one or the other. Either we're following the law, or we're following the Lord Jesus Christ. And if there's no death to the law, then there can be no marriage to Jesus Christ. That's the first thing. And then secondly, we've said how the law arouses sinful passions, and they produce fruit for death. That's verse 5, isn't it, really? Law leads to sin, and sin leads to death. That's the order there, to simplify it, isn't it? It's the law, then, that shows us our sin, and sin itself, of course, leads to death. And then the other thing we've said is that Christians are released from the law to serve in the newness that the Holy Spirit brings. That's verse 6. A spirit-controlled life is impossible until we are first released from the law. So all that, I think, can give the impression that the law is in fact bad. Paul sounds a little bit like an antinomian, somebody who's against the law. And you may wonder about this. You might say, well, how can something that came from God, God gave the law, how can the law be such a bad thing? But of course, the truth is that the law is not bad. There's nothing wrong with the law itself. I'm sure it's important that we avoid extremes, isn't it? Some people say that if the law can't save you, well, then it must be pretty useless and pretty unimportant. But the right way to think about the law is that though it can't save you, you can't be saved by the law. It's no good saying, well, I'm going to do this, do this, do this, and that will get me to heaven. Although the law can't save you, there are a lot of other good things that the law can do for you. I was thinking about this. I was thinking, it's like salt, isn't it? You know, they're always telling us, aren't they, that salt is no good for you. And it's particularly bad for some people. So say you came to the conclusion that you can eat no salt, you don't want to add any salt to any of the food that you eat from now on. Now you might be tempted then to say, well, I'm going to cut salt right out. I'm not going to have anything to do with salt. And you might look through your cupboards and say, right, I'm going to throw out all this salt, isn't it? It's no use. Now hold on, don't do that. Because as you know, salt is useful for other things, isn't it? Salt, when the snows come back, perhaps next winter, we want a bit of salt to put on the path to help the snow to melt. Slugs and snails. You might have a problem with slugs and snails. I understand that putting salt on them will soon see them off. There are various healing processes and other medicinal uses for salt. You can use salt then to clean things. It can be very useful in certain cleaning processes. You can make salt dough for the kids to play with. You can do all sorts of things with salt. So you see what I'm saying, isn't it? Yes, salt, okay, for you. Maybe it'd be particularly for you. Eating it, not a good idea. Best to leave it. It's just going to do you harm. But that doesn't mean to say that salt is useless entirely. There are other things that you can use it for. Now, in a similar way, the law can't save you. Be clear about that. The idea then of trying to do the things that are set down for us in the Ten Commandments or in any other set of rules and thinking that by doing those things you're going to get to heaven is not going to work. But don't go to an extreme then and say, well, I don't need the law anymore. The law is useless. Why do we read it together on a Sunday morning? Why do we bother with it at all? That would be an overreaction and a great mistake. That is not the situation. And so I want to say three things this evening. One very briefly at the beginning, and then most of the time we'll spend on the second point, and then there's a third point at the end. And the first thing I want to say is quite negative, I suppose, but then the rest of it is quite positive. So negatively then, the first thing we want to say is that the law is not sin. Just to underline this and make this clear. Back in chapter 6, if you have your Bible opened at chapter 7, you can easily turn back to chapter 6. And you notice the first verse there asks a question. What shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? And then in verse 15, something very similar. What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? By no means. And now in chapter 7 and verse 7, Paul asks a similar question, not about sin this time, but about the law. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. If law is the origin of sin, then is it also true to say that the law is sin? If we're saying that it's law then that causes sin to be seen and in one sense makes us sin, well then surely the law is a bad thing. Surely law is sin. The law is sinful, we might be tempted to say. The law is responsible for causing sin. But Paul leaves us in no doubt on that question, does he? What should we say then? Is the law sin? No way. Certainly not. The law is not sin. So, if it is not the cause of sin then, what does it do? So that's the first point, very simply. The law is not sin. What does it actually do then? Well, that's the second thing, and the thing that I want to spend most of our time on, what the law actually does. And Paul mentions three important things that the law does. First of all, it reveals sin. See, he goes on, doesn't he, in verse 7, he says, "Indeed, I would not have known what sin was, except through the law." He said something very similar already back in chapter 3 and verse 20. He says, "Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law we become conscious of sin." Okay, so that's what the law can do for you, isn't it? Through the law we become conscious of sin. I would not have known what sin was except through the law. And so it's by means of the law that we come to know that we are sinners then, isn't it? The Garden of Eden, I suppose, that's one of the lessons from the Garden of Eden. It's like a stick, isn't it? You look at this pond, perhaps it's in your garden, and you look at this pond, it looks very nice. Then you get the stick, and you stir it up. And you can see then that there's all sorts of muck and horrible things there in that water. And the law is like a stick then. It stirs things up. It shows you how dirty things really are. And it's not then that sin is impossible without the law, but that we only know that something is sinful in the light of the law. Left to ourselves, we don't really grasp what sinners we are. And even when we admit that we've done wrong, we don't really accept that we are transgressors then, that we are those who have broken the holy law of God. I remember when I was a boy, sometimes my mother would say, "You can play outside, you know, when the darker nights are here. It's not really very late." And so we used to play outside in the dark. I always used to think it was great fun playing outside in the dark. But there was this weird thing that happened. You'd be out playing in the dark, and yeah, okay, you fell over now and again, you slipped down a bank maybe, but as far as you could tell, you were pretty clean. But then it was time to go in. And you'd come into the house and the lights would be on and you'd look at your trousers and your arms and say, "Where did all that mud come from? How on earth did that get there?" And my mother was usually very fussy about things like that. She was very appalled at how mucky I'd managed to get in such a short time. And the law's like that. You see, the law's like a light then that shines. And it shows you that. You see that how sinful you are. It shows us that we are sinners. It shows us that we have sinned against God. And that's how the law works then. This is one of the reasons people react against the law. They don't want the law because it reminds them of just how wrong and how sinful they are. Paul gives an example from his own experience of how one particular command had an impact on him. It's the 10th command of course, the command about coveting. Paul says, "For I would not have known what coveting really was if the law had not said, 'Do not covet.'" Now, there's some debate over exactly the point that Paul is making here, but certainly the 10th commandment is different to all the others, isn't it, in that it explicitly talks about what is going on the inside. The other commandments only explicitly talk about what is going on the outside. Obviously, implicitly, they are talking about what goes on the inside. But the 10th commandment is very definitely about what is going on the inside. I think it's the clue, isn't it, for suggesting to us that we ought to look at the other commandments like that. And if you read the Sermon on the Mount, that's pretty much what Jesus does, isn't it? He says, well, it's no good taking those commandments and just thinking they're outward things, saying, well, I've never murdered anybody, so I'm all right. If you've got angry with somebody, if you've called somebody a fool, well, you're on your way to committing the sin of murder, and we ought to recognise that that's the case. You see, Paul at one stage really did begin to think that he was perfect. He writes to the Philippians, remember, he says, as to legalistic righteousness, faultless. You know, he could go through those commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. Paul had never even thought of bowing down to an idol. There was no way that there was going to be another God before the true God. There was no way he was going to bow down to an idol against the second command. As far as he was concerned, he never misused the name of God. He kept the Sabbath. He honoured his parents and his rabbinic fathers. He honoured them. And he wasn't a man who was guilty of stealing or adultery or murder or of deceit, as far as he was concerned. But then he came to this 10th commandment. And this was the weird thing. As far as Paul could tell, there was a time when he'd not really been particularly covetous. He hadn't wanted gold or silver or any of those things. He'd not wanted to be a great preacher like Stephen, the deacon. But when he looked at that commandment about not coveting, well, that was a strange thing. Paul suddenly discovered there was all sorts of coveting in his heart, all sorts of things he wanted that he didn't have. And it reminds us then that we need to look at ourselves in the light of the whole of God's law. I'm sure there are some laws, all of us here, some commands, you look at them and you say, well, I've never had any problem with that. I'm not a particularly hateful person. Extremely rare for me to even get annoyed with somebody. There might be somebody like that, and it's not a problem. But then I come to another commandment. Whoa, I feel like I'm doing that all the time, you see, when you properly understand what those commandments mean. But it's the whole of the law that we've got to keep. It's just like that hole in the tire, isn't it? The hole may be only in one place in the tire, but once you've got a hole in it, the whole tire is down, isn't it? And once you break one of those commandments, the whole thing collapses. So what does the law do? Well, first of all, it reveals sin. It reveals sin. It's like those tablets you can get that they don't clean your teeth, but they show where all the plaque is on your teeth. They reveal then what is wrong. And the law works like that. But it's more than that. This is the second thing, isn't it? It provokes sin. Doesn't just reveal sin, but it provokes sin. See, Paul goes further, doesn't he, in verse 8, and he describes how sin's reaction to the law is often to fly in its face. But sin, he says, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. For apart from the law, sin is dead. Back in verse 5, he said, doesn't he, when we were controlled by the sinful nature, the sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our bodies, and so we bore fruit for death. And here in verse 8, he uses the word, it's the word opportunity that is used to translate it here in the NIV, and it's a word, it basically means base of operations. It's a military term, base of operations. And a base of operations is a place then where an army or some other force can gather itself together, and from that base then it can launch out and make attacks in other directions. One of the reasons that we have soldiers in Afghanistan at the moment is because the country is apparently being used as a base of operations by Al-Qaeda for their acts of terrorism. And so Western nations then want to respond and try and deal with that, what is going on in Afghanistan. Now, Paul's point is that sin can make law then a base of operations. It can make it a springboard for its advances. And the more Paul thought about this 10th commandment, rather than turning him away from sin, instead the worse it seemed to become. And I think it's sheer naivety that thinks that law is going to somehow automatically crush opposition to sin. You know, very often law can have the complete opposite effect. It can actually provoke sin. It can stir sin up. That stick that's going in the pond, then it can stir things up. But there are many examples of this naivety. You know, we've got many problems in this country, haven't we? One of the problems we have is teenage pregnancy. Another problem we have is drug addiction. And opinion is divided as to how we're going to tackle that. But certainly, simply telling people not to do it is not going to work, is it? It's wrong for teenagers to become pregnant. They should wait until they're older. It's not going to work, is it? Drugs can cause you all sorts of a problem. Just say no. And that's not going to work. Anybody who is naive enough to think that that's going to deal with our problems is very foolish indeed. Now this phenomenon is called, if you want a nice word for this, contra-suggestibility. That's the word that some people use. Suggestibility is, you know, open to suggestion, isn't it? And contra-suggestibility means that the very thing you suggest to them, they do the opposite. Contra-suggestibility. There's a propensity then to act negatively to any directive. Whatever you tell them to do, they do the opposite. And of course it's more obvious in others, in some than it is in others, but it's latent in us all. You know, you see a sign, it says, reduce speed now. Now, I trust most of you reduce speed now, but some of us, you see a sign that says, reduce speed now. You say, well, I'm not going to do it quite now. I'm going to see why they've got that sign there. I'm going to do it in a little while. Private, do not enter. Something in some of us just wants to know, what's private? What's behind that door? Why mustn't I enter? Against regulations, it says. Who says it's against regulations? Who says I can't do this thing? Don't touch. Wow. You know, I said to you, this glass of water, I don't want any of you, before you go home tonight, I don't want any of you to touch it. Don't, whatever you do, I can touch the glass, it's my glass, but don't you dare touch it. Oh, it suddenly, yeah, I didn't notice it was there. Suddenly it looks attractive. I'm going to go up and touch it afterwards. I'm going to have a good joke with the minister afterwards and say, I touched it. Well, you may forget, but don't touch it. You know, Augustine in his Confessions, he talks about how he stole pears. He was just a boy. And they stole pears then from an orchard. And he admits then that he did it for no reason other than it was not allowed. He admits the fruit was beautiful, but it was not that which my miserable soul coveted. I had plenty of better pears. There were loads of good pears that he could get hold of very easily. But those I picked solely with the motive of stealing. I threw away what I picked, but I enjoyed the stealing. I remember doing a similar thing. I remember going with somebody who wants to steal. I didn't sort of think of it as stealing, but yes, I suppose I must have realized it was stealing. Crab apples. I had them in a shoebox for a long time, crab apples. I didn't know what to do with them. You can't eat them. I remember another incident. I didn't spend, these are two isolated incidents, I assure you. cases of we tried to steal apples from a farmer, and he caught us. He lined us all up against the wall and told us what terrible boys we were. And I did feel very bad about it, but you know, if my mother offered me an apple at home, I would have said no, thank you. I'll eat something else. It wasn't that there was a great desire for apples. There was a minister in the 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia some years ago. He's now with the Lord, a man called James Montgomery Boyce. And he has this story about how he was in school. It must have been the end of junior school. And he was in school one day, and the headmaster came into the classroom, the principal, as they tend to call them in America. And it was just before lunch. And the headmaster said he'd heard that there'd been boys had been bringing fireworks, or firecrackers, as they say, into school. And he wanted everyone in the class to know not only that they were not to let fireworks off in the school, but they weren't to bring fireworks to the school. It was a dangerous thing to do, and it was not allowed then by the Pennsylvania state law for anyone to bring a firecracker into school. And anybody who was caught would be expelled immediately. "Well," says Boyce, "I didn't own any firecrackers. I hadn't even been thinking about firecrackers. But you know, when you get to thinking about firecrackers, that really is a very intriguing subject. And as I thought about them, I remembered that one of my friends had some. And so on the way home for lunch, a friend and I went by this other friend's house, and we picked up a firecracker and returned to school with it 45 minutes later. That's all it took, 3/4 of an hour, that's all it took. We went into the cloakroom, we invited another boy to come with us, and we said, "Now you hold the firecracker by the middle of the fuse. You pinch it very tight, and then we will light it. The others will think it's going to explode. But when it burns down to your fingers, it will go out, and everything will be all right." Well, what we hadn't counted on, he says, was that the lighted fuse would burn our friend's fingers. And when it did, our friend dropped the firecracker. It exploded in an immense cloud of blue smoke and tiny bits of white paper, in the midst of which we emerged, a bit shaken, from the closet. Well, you cannot imagine how loud a firecracker sounds in an old school building with high ceilings, marble floors and plaster walls. Nor can you imagine how quickly a principal can rush out of his office, down the hall and into one of the classrooms. The principal was there even before my friends and I had staggered through the cloakroom's open door. He was as stunned as we were, though differently. I remember him saying over and over again, after we had been sent home and had come back to his office with our parents, "I just made the announcement. I just told them not to bring any firecrackers into school. I just can't believe it." Well, that became a phrase, didn't it, later? "I can't believe it." So the problem here then is not the law. The law's fine. I think it's a good rule, isn't it? Don't bring fireworks into school. I can't see anything particularly terrible about a law like that. Don't pick the farmer's apples. If they don't belong to you, leave them on the tree and let him deal with them. But it is the perversity of sinful human nature that is the problem. It twists the law from its work of exposing and condemning, so that in the end it encourages and it provokes sin. Sin leads to a bad reaction to the law, and the only good thing that does come out from it then is that we, when we react like this, we come to realize just how very sinful we really are. You know, we sometimes think we're not so bad, and then something like that happens. You say, "But you were told," and yet you reacted, and you did the very opposite of what you were told. And it shows us how very strong sin can be. Well, I hope you've understood that and you've seen it for yourself. So what does the law do? It reveals sin. It provokes sin. And then this is the thing I want to come on to finally in this main heading. It brings us to an end of ourselves. See, in verse 9, Paul says, "Once I was alive apart from the law. But when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died." So I think there are four stages here, aren't there? First of all, here's Paul alive apart from the law. He felt secure, naively so, but he felt things were okay. He imagined that everything was okay with him. And that's the position of the lost sinner by nature, isn't it? You think of a young child who's thinks of themselves as being very innocent, thinks that they've never done anything really wrong. Well, we've been there, some of us. Or a young person who's never been to church, has never been told that he's a sinner. There must be hundreds of children in this general area, and they think they're pretty good. They don't think they're sinners, certainly. They don't think there's anything particularly wrong. And not just children, sadly, but adults as well, who think they're pretty good. They're pretty much okay. She could be alive then, apart from the law. And then the commandment comes. See, when the real demands of the law are brought home, well, it changes, doesn't it? You find out that it's not just a matter of not murdering people, but every time you lose your temper with somebody, every time then you've got that feeling, oh, I wish he wasn't here, then you've taken the first step on the road to murder. Every time then you answer your parents back, or you wish then they weren't telling you what to do and how to live and what time to go to bed. Every time then there's a bit of discontent. You say, oh, I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a little bit richer. I wish I didn't live exactly here. I wish that the next few days would disappear and I was already at the point that you're thinking about. Whenever we fall into those sins, if we know what the law says, well, the commandment comes, doesn't it? And what happens? Sin. That's the third thing, isn't it? Sin springs to life. You know, through the law, we realize what great sinners we are, but it doesn't make us not want to do it. We suddenly realize how fascinating, how interesting, how desirable that is. People do some weird, weird things. And you think, why? Why are they doing it? Some of those things, I can think the only explanation is because it's not allowed. That can be the only explanation. There can't be any pleasure, there can't be any use in those things. But they do it. Why? Because they're not allowed to do it. That's why they do those things. And the fourth thing is, and says Paul, I died. I came to the end of myself. He was no longer the self-satisfied, the self-secure person that he'd once been, the man who thought he had it all. No, that law, and it was particularly for Paul, that law against coveting that brought him to the end of himself. And so in verse 10 he says that the law that was intended to bring life, Leviticus chapter 18, verse 5, God says, keep my decrees and laws, for the man who obeys them will live by them. Nothing wrong with the law. You'll live if you keep these laws. Well, the law that was intended to bring life, because of sin then, it has brought about not life, but death. I found that the very commandment that was intended to bring life actually brought death. It brought Paul then to the end of himself. And he saw that he could do nothing to save himself. There was no way he could deliver himself. For sin, verse 11, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, deceived me, and through the commandment, put me to death. The self-righteous think they can save themselves, of course. They think that they can somehow then be good enough for God. Isaiah 64 and verse 6 points out that sin deceives by giving the impression then that the law is somehow going to benefit us automatically. It makes excuses for more sin. And so Isaiah says all of us have become like one who's unclean. All our righteous acts, what are they? Filthy rags. I think it's worse than that, that what Isaiah actually says, but we'll leave it at filthy rags, shall we? It's unclean. We all shrivel up like a leaf, and like the wind, our sins sweep us away. Now, where are you at in this series? That's the question this evening, isn't it? I would be surprised if there's anybody here who's alive apart from the law. Maybe one or two younger ones think that they're innocent and they've never done anything wrong. Well, they need to learn that that isn't the case, is it? It's not the situation. They need to hear the law. And it may be that you're one then to whom the law has come, and you've begun to grasp, you've just begun to get a little idea of what a rotten sinner you are. Well, there's more to come. You need to come to an end of yourself, isn't it? You need to realize that you are riddled with sin, that sin is in every pore, every fiber of your body. Everything in you rebels against God. You don't like God. You don't want to do what God says. You don't want to serve God. You don't want to spend forever and forever praising God in heaven. Everything in you rebels against it. And we need to stop thinking then that the law can save us. That somehow, okay, we have our bad moments, but you know, we can get ourselves together and we can start being the sort of people that we ought to be. It won't work. You can't do it. There's nothing that we can do. Rather, we've got to cast ourselves on the Lord and beg for his mercy. It's the only hope. It's the only hope. And the law drives us to that. That's why we've got to keep preaching the law. That's why I want us to read the Ten Commandments, at least from time to time. Because the commandments, oh, they won't save us. They remind us that it hasn't been as good a week as perhaps we thought it was. It hasn't been as good a life as perhaps we thought it was. We've sinned, we've sinned, we've sinned. We've broken the law of God. And so then the final thing is this. Verse 12, Paul says, so then, the law is holy. And the commandment is holy, righteous, and good. In the words of 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 56, the power of sin is the law. It's interesting, Paul puts it that way, isn't it? The power of sin is the law. See, sin is the problem, not the law. Nothing wrong with the law at all. God's law is holy, it's righteous, it's good. It's inherently good, it's intended to do good. We mustn't speak against the law. We mustn't downplay the law. You know, there are many Christians who think that they have no need for the law. But the law is irrelevant then to their lives now they're in the Lord Jesus Christ. That is, there's a mistake. It's a misunderstanding. The law is perfectly fine. It's us. That's the problem. The good that the law does doesn't save anyone. But it does show people their need of salvation. And so on the one hand, we shouldn't have too high a view of the law, certainly. But we mustn't have too low a view of the law either. The law is good, isn't it? You know those first two commands about having no other gods before him and avoiding adultery. What a great thing it is to show us the danger of idolatry. You could turn anything into an idol. And what a vile and horrible thing idolatry is. That fourth commandment, isn't it, that says we've got to take that day of rest. Now left to ourselves, some of us, we'd work all 7 days of the week and we'd never stop and we'd never worship God as we ought to. But the fourth commandment is there. It's a good, good command, and we ought to be thankful for it. The fifth command, it puts a child then under the care of those who love him most. All of us, when we were children, we would rebel against a commandment like that to a greater or lesser extent. Then we don't want to listen to what our parents say. But there's the command. It's there. It's a good command. It's a great command. The seventh commandment, it guards the sacredness of marriage. And although all sorts of pressure is coming to bear against that command, it's a good command and one that we ought to seek to uphold in every way. And the problem is sin, isn't it? We're stirred then into rebellion against God, into a constant round of work, no time for him. The breakdown of society that we see, the unhappy families that we see, it goes back to a rejection of the law in case after case. So we need to see both sides, don't we? We need to thank God for the law. We need to pray that he'll have the right effect on us as individuals and bring us to the end of ourselves. That's one of its functions, isn't it, for both the unbeliever and the believer, to bring us to the end of ourselves. Paul asks in verse 13, did that which is good then become death to me? Well, by no means, he says. In order that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me through what was good, so that through the commandment sin might become utterly sinful. The command did it, and it showed Paul just what a rotten and wicked sinner he was. So two things, isn't it? I think you're clear on this now. The law can't save you. Get rid of any last remaining thought you might have that you can somehow save yourself by the law. To think like that is to deceive yourself. But the law, and that's the second thing, isn't it? The law can show you how vile and how sinful you are and your great need of the Lord Jesus Christ. So do pay attention to the law. Try and learn the Ten Commandments. Think about the Ten Commandments. Love the Ten Commandments, because they can do you so much good. The late John Gerstner, another American then, used to tell a story about a woman. He preached like this, and then he went to stand by the door. And this woman came to him afterwards, and she said, "You made me feel that big during that sermon." I don't know how you'd react if somebody said something like that to you. He said, "Oh, still too big then. You're still too big then. That much self-righteousness will land you in hell."